The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and so much more. We have lots to get to this week, so let's get to it. I'm going to talk about the new season of Andor, the Star Wars for Grown-Ups show. That's what how they marketed it. Talk about Andor with Scott Gold, our frequent contributor and resident Star Wars nerd. He and I have a lot to say about Andor, and that'll be coming up very shortly. And I'm also going to talk to Stephen Garrett about a bunch of things involving the world of film, including this last weekend's box office bonanza that took everyone by surprise. And we're also going to talk about two recent movies. We're going to give them an audio review of sorts, The Accountant 2, the Ben Affleck franchise vehicle that was out this weekend, and the new movie from David Cronenberg, The Shrouds, which was not a big blockbuster, but it's a David Cronenberg movie, so it's always worth talking about. But first, Andor Season 2, right after this, a trailer for Andor Season 2.
The Empire cannot win.
The revolution's coming alive.
This day has finally come. This is do or die.
I'm thinking like a soldier.
Scott Gold and I have a habit on this show of watching the first couple of episodes of a season and then turning you all loose onto that show. And we've made some, I would consider some pretty poor judgment calls over the years. I remember us semi-gushing over the first couple of episodes of The Acolyte, a Star Wars show. And we also, more recently, were full of praise for Daredevil Born Again. Neither of those shows stuck the landing, to say the least. They were not only disappointing, but almost abysmally bad in the end. However, I don't think we're going to be saying the same thing about season two of Andor, which is now airing on Disney Plus and is also a Star Wars show. Scott Gold is here. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Neil. Great to be back on the pod.
Hello. So we're going to roll the dice on Andor, I think, right?
Absolutely. I think the odds are ever in our favor for this particular slice of Star Wars, especially seeing that, you know, the same creative team is back. They're building on something really, really wonderful that a lot of people, and not just, you know, old school Star Wars heads like myself and you, really, really appreciated about season one. And they are just not letting up. And apparently Disney just gave them the go ahead to do their thing. And their thing is dark. And that sort of darkness is something we don't see very often in Star Wars, especially a very adult kind of darkness. And it's a little tough to watch, but also very refreshing for a franchise that's been a little overstuffed recently.
It's dark, although, you know, before I watched it, and I literally, as we're talking, about 10 minutes ago, finished watching the third episode. They dropped three episodes last Tuesday as we talked. And by the time anyone listens to this, there'll be more episodes out. It is dark, and I heard dark Star Wars, but I expected it to be have adult themes, let us say, but I did not expect it to be as entertaining as it was.
Yeah.
Full of swashbuckling action and drama and humor, all kinds of great stuff, and subtlety, like the kinds of subtle writing and sort of subtle character work that you just don't see in Star Wars.
Absolutely. You know, I actually went back in advance of season two and rewatched all of season one. Wasn't really planning on doing that, but once I got started, it was really, really difficult to stop, which is a real testament to how great the writing and the execution of this show is. And season two is not just more of the same, but I think it improves on whatever formula, whatever magic formula they discovered for season one. And yes, again, like dark themes, adult themes, like a lot of spycraft, a lot of, you know, what goes into building a rebellion against a fascist empire, which is, I think, has been oft glanced over in the Star Wars films in favor of a more cartoonish kind of evil. You know, you have the cackling emperor and, you know, Darth Vader and his scary mask and breathing apparatus and stuff. But, you know, fascism is terrifying in its banality and its efficiency and the way that it can just absolutely crush people under their boot heels. And that to me is even scarier because that's something that we see in the real world way more than, you know, Jedis and Sith with laser swords. So it's relatable in its terror and its plausibility. And that's what makes it so compelling is that we get to see the roots of this rebellion form. And at this point, we're in Star Wars terms, what we call 4BBY, which is four years before the Battle of Yavin, meaning before the episode, before the events of Rogue One and A New Hope. So 4 years from when Luke Skywalker pilots that X-Wing and drops the proton torpedo into the famed exhaust port and blows the thing to smithereens. But still, at this point, it's not the Rebel Alliance that we come to know and love that is a lot more organized. It's like a real military operation. And at this point, it's just different factions and bands. And we have a few players at the high ends of power and influence who are low-key financing and supporting the rebellion, trying not to get discovered because, you know what the fascists are going to do to them. And we see it happen. We saw it happen in season one with the torture scene, which was absolutely brutal and terrifying and really cemented the stakes of what happens if you support the rebellion and you get found out. And it's just, it's utterly mesmerizing and hard to just, you know, break your attention away from it, which means that it's just really, truly masterful storytelling. And the fact that it's also Star Wars and there are tons of Easter eggs and callbacks and, you know, little things that fans might pick up on is also a lot of fun. And like you said, the humor, you know, it definitely does a great job of using levity to balance those really heavy, dark, scary, terrifying moments in a very Star Wars kind of way.
Well, what I like about it, too, is that, I mean, it's obvious who the good guys and the bad guys are. I mean, the Empire and the Rebellion are, you know, have long been sort of established as the polar opposites of the Star Wars universe. But as you mentioned, there are no lightsabers. There's no sort of magic Jedi mumbo jumbo. It's all sort of very, to use a Marvel term, street level stuff, although there's lots of people flying around from planet to planet. But what I thought was interesting is that, you know, some of the bad guys, the Empire people, are quite human and have very human relationships and human foibles and are sympathetic, or at least their motivations are understandable, even if they're sort of baldly careerist. And you don't find yourself rooting for them, but you find yourself understanding why they're doing what they're doing. They're not just kind of twirling their mustaches.
Exactly. Right?
And on the flip side, you know, especially in the first three episodes, the show shows that some of the rebellion people are bumbling idiots.
Right, which is kind of hilarious. We see, the first episode, and spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't seen the first episode of Andor season two. The opening is fantastic. We have Cassian Andor disguised as a Imperial test pilot stealing a highly advanced TIE fighter that it turns out he doesn't really know how to operate. Like, putting him in that position is really fantastic television because you're really gunning for him literally to get out of this situation that just all kind of goes to hell really, really quickly.
Yeah. I literally, when he did the opening bit where you figure out that he doesn't know what he's doing, I literally shouted, "Oh shit," at the TV. And I never do that. You know, I never react authentically to anything because I've seen so many things and I'm so jaded.
I think I had literally the same reaction, and I thought it was just brilliant because you're ready for him to like blast off triumphantly. And of course I knew, like, I was like, this is too quiet. Like, this is not going to go as smoothly as it seems, but I didn't know what exactly was going to happen. And the way it plays out is highly entertaining.
So good.
And it results in Cassian kind of crash landing the ship on a forest planet which we get a little Easter egg at the end of that arc, by the way, that that planet happens to be Yavin 4, which is where the original Rebel base in A New Hope was, which is fun. But he's down there, you know, he gets picked up, you know, he gets captured by this scrappy band of kind of buffoonish rebels who are marooned there, and they're squabbling amongst themselves. They're not very bright, and he's just trying to get out of the situation.
They're very, very hungry. And that was almost just, it's just a subplot. And that, but that's the thing that Andor does well, is it sort of sets up these like situational subplots that are related to, but just kind of side bits of tension to the main plot. All right, so you know, basically, it's the same cast, right? You know, Diego Luna plays Andor like he does in the first season and in Rogue One, and you have Genevieve O'Reilly is playing Mon Mothma, who we know survives because she's in Return of the Jedi. That character,
yeah, she makes it all the way through. One of the rare survival stories from the very early days of Star Wars until. After Return of the Jedi, which is pretty great. And she's been doing that role for a really long time. I think since Rogue One or before. I know she played Mon Mothma in the Clone Wars animated series, but she does a really, really wonderful job of playing this politician who's covertly financing the rebels and the concessions that she has to make in her personal life, including marrying her only daughter off to the son of a Chandrillan mob boss in order to hide her money and her finances from the Empire. And it's, you know, you see the costs that have to be paid in order to build a rebellion. And it's really captivating stuff. And I think she plays the role so wonderfully and elegantly. And it's a great contrast, you know, seeing all these, the high levels of power and influence and, you know, the swanky, well-to-do people on Coruscant and the spectacular costumes. And we have to note this, the costuming in this show is just wonderful. Stark contrast with that to these scrappy rebels on the ground who are just going hungry and, you know, fighting amongst themselves. And it's a lot of highbrow, lowbrow kind of stuff.
Mud and dirt. You know, it is a Star Wars show, first and foremost. There are still some creatures. There's still lasers. There's still spaceships flying around all over the place. There's still stormtroopers. But in a lot of ways, it gives off almost a Game of Thrones vibe. The way it's paced, the way the characters shift in subtle ways, the way that things don't always turn out how you would like for your favorites. It feels like it's drawing from that playbook, especially the early seasons of Game of Thrones.
Absolutely. And I actually mentioned in my review that this feels more like an HBO drama than a Disney Plus show, which, you know, got to hand it to Disney for giving them the leeway and the leverage to do their thing, which started in Rogue One when they, you know, Tony Gilroy said, you know, the only way to really make this work, they're never going to let me do it, is to just kill everybody off because they're not in Episode 4, A New Hope. Like, what happens to all these characters? How do we explain it? And he was shocked when they said, okay, yeah, go ahead, do it. And it made for a really, really tremendous film. And that feeling that no one is safe is a very Game of Thrones feeling. And I totally get that in Andor way more than in any of the other Star Wars shows or movies where you know the main characters are safe. They're the main characters, you know, like nothing is going to happen to Rey, you know, like we got to see Luke's whole arc.
Boba Fett.
Exactly.
Or Obi-Wan, right. Kenobi.
Like, nothing's going to happen to them.
And if it does happen, they can come back as Force ghosts.
Yeah, right. It all makes sense from a certain point of view.
And it's not the point of view of Andor. Scott, on behalf of Scott and I, I'd like to officially apologize for our positive review of The Acolyte, and especially, I think, Scott, for our positive review of Daredevil Born Again. But we're not going to have to apologize about Andor Season 2, which I think is really going to go down as one of the best TV shows of the year.
I absolutely agree, and I'm really hoping that it's going to be up for some awards, especially with the acting. Even some of the bit players, you know, are just really, really killing it. And it's just a stacked cast. The writing is brilliant. The directing is great. It doesn't feel like George Lucas, which is weird for Star Wars. Like that, it's not feeling George Lucas-y is actually a real benefit to the show. And that's one of the reasons that I love it. It's not your typical Star Wars. It's not a kid's show. It's very much an adult Star Wars. And I am 100% here for it, man.
Yes, sir. Me too. And again, like I said, I don't feel like it's going to disappoint us in the end. You and I will have to have a little conversation about Daredevil once we're off the air. We're out of time here, but don't listen, Scott. If I radio you in the middle of the night, you better answer because it's going to be important.
Absolutely, sir. I'll have all frequencies open.
What do you want?
It's me, your brother.
I know you can't tell from the tone of my voice that I know it's you.
I need your help.
I need to know who killed Ray King. Let me do the talking.
Guess I hit him harder than I thought.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
It's been quite a week for movies in Hollywood, in the world, in America, but really Hollywood. There is a story that came out at the end of last week. Like Thursday or something, where I think his name is Ted Sarandos. Stephen Garrett's here. Hello, Stephen.
Oh, hi.
Yeah.
Yeah, this guy, Ted something, Sarandos. Yeah.
Sarandos from Netflix, the CEO of Netflix, was like, oh, people don't like going to see the movies and go to the movies anymore. Everyone's happy just staying at home. And
is
then,
this where he said, like, people can't walk to the multiplex?
Yeah.
I was like, when did people ever walk to the multiplex? That's a boneheaded.
Yeah, I wasn't walking to the multiplex in the 80s.
No.
You know, I was driving. The whole point of the multiplex is that you drive to the multiplex.
I rode my bike to the multiplex.
Yes, you can do that. You can do that. Anyway, but he was just basically like, everyone just wants to watch Netflix. No one wants to watch, go to the movies anymore. And then lo and behold, at the movies, this last weekend, the Sinners, which you and I talked, not The Sinners, Sinners, which you and I talked about last week, which is one of the most original Hollywood movies in years, one of the best movies I've seen in the theater in a long time. Not only equaled its previous weekend's box office, it actually made a little more money.
Wait, you're kidding? This weekend?
This weekend? Yeah, like just by a little bit, but that's unheard of.
Whoa, that's like Titanic level.
Yes. Well,
holding on.
This is a game changing movie. I've been saying that, and then on top of that, okay, so that's one hit movie. But then to add a little more fuel to Ted Sarandos's fire, The Revenge of the Sith. This the final episode. It came out. It was re-released, 25th anniversary, I believe, of the re-release for Revenge of the Sith, and that made $25 million. Even though you could watch it on TV right now, it's on Disney Plus. You could watch it, at home. But that made $25 million. And, and then there were some other movies. The Minecraft movie continues to burn up the box office. People are seeing it again and again. And we've talked about all of these. We haven't talked about Revenge of the Sith on this show, but it came out in 2005.
That's fair.
But we've talked about all those other movies. But, even a movie like the one that you reviewed for us this week, Stephen, The Accountant 2, even that made $20+ million. And that was that's your number three or number four movie. And so, you know what? Eat it, Ted Sarandos. People still...
That's right. Movies are back. Movies are back.
If they've ever been back, they're back this week,
They came back this week. I don't know if they'll be back next month, but they're...
No, but...
Right now, they're back.
Well, but the summer's coming. There's a couple of Marvel movies. There's a Superman movie. There's a Mission Impossible movie. There's movies. There's movies to see.
Yeah.
And people are... clearly, people have an appetite for them again and for the going to see them in the theater. So there. So there, we win, you lose.
Yay.
all right, so you saw The Accountant 2.
I did.
Which is obviously a sequel to The Accountant 1.
Apparently, yeah.
Which at the time was not considered The Accountant 1. It was the only Accountant. And that movie is 9 years old at this point, right?
It came out in 2016, apparently. Yeah.
So 9 years.
I don't remember when it came out. I asked you before we started talking if you had seen it. You hadn't. I hadn't, actually. I saw it to get ready to see Accountant 2 and, of course, read about how this movie, The Accountant, was a modest box office hit when it came out, but it got really long legs, on VOD and streaming, and people love it, and it plays on cable all the time. In fact, I caught up with it over the past week or so because it was on cable so much that it was very easy to find.
You watched on TV? Was it on TBS or something like that?
I watched it. I think it was in HBO. It was one of the HBO channels. And I was actually pleasantly surprised. It was the first movie that Gavin O'Connor was the director. He directed this one too. And that first one he directs with a really kind of assured sense of how to place the camera, what he's doing with the camera. It has a really interesting sort of structure that I think it's Bill Dubuque wrote the original, also wrote this new one. But it's a very sad film. It's a very melancholy film about alienation and loneliness. And Ben Affleck's character is a guy who has...
he's autistic.
He's autistic. I was like Asperger's. He's autistic, which means that at least his form of autism is one where he sharpens... He's very good at math. He's very good at seeing patterns, and he has made a very fruitful career of that. Unfortunately, his father, who was in the military and kind of was overwhelmed when his wife left him with these two sons, one of whom was autistic, the older one, who was played by Ben Affleck, and then the other, who was Braxton, who was played by John Bernthal when he grows up. This military dad was tasked with raising these two boys, and he didn't want them to suffer in the world, so he trained them basically to be killers, like actually world-class assassins, weirdly enough. Like it's an odd thing for a father to do.
Yeah, of course. Look, my dad was in the military too. He couldn't even teach me to iron my shirts.
But do you know, did you go to Jakarta and like learn training, like Asian martial arts?
No, we went to San Diego.
Okay. Apparently these guys did. So anyway, you end up with this sort of like dweeby John Wick type who is Ben Affleck, who will do your taxes and also kick your ass, you know?
Yeah.
And he's got this estranged relationship with his brother that was very brooding in the first movie. And it was really played very seriously and very kind of, it was actually quite affecting in a strange way, but the movie took itself very, very seriously. In this one, it's almost like they said, hey, let's do a buddy comedy instead. And they come up with a kind of a trumped up story that involves MS-13 and this, you know, kind of human trafficking. And it gets very convoluted and very unnecessarily complex in a way that really is the only thing that matters clearly to the director and the writer is let's get these two guys back together again so that John Bernthal can be like this bro who's trying to bond with his very closed and uptight brother.
It's so odd to me because it's the same writer and director.
Yeah. I mean, I think actually, you know, hats off to the fact that they wanted to make a different, tonally different movie. Like, I kind of weirdly like it when sequels feel different or a different type of movie or even a different type of genre. It's like Aliens and Alien. It's like that leap, I think, is hilarious. But this is just so odd because the first one was actually quite moving. And again, had that kind of directorial like vision and sense of control. And this one feels just a little more kind of workmanlike. He's just kind of knocking it out and going through the rounds. And I don't know.
There's like a line dance. There's like a line dancing scene and like
there's a speed dating scene. And he does line dancing in like a cowboy bar. And I don't know. You just there are a lot of head scratching moments where you're like, what are we watching? What are we doing? And then they bring up this thing where, you know, there's this ruthless killer, this mysterious ruthless killer named Anais, whose story, of course, dovetails eventually with the one that they're telling. But she has like acquired autism syndrome, where it is something like if you get a traumatic blow, then you can actually become autistic and also become a lethal killer, which is like weirdly convenient.
Oh, it's not because she got a vaccine. No, or something.
It was just like, what? I don't know. It just seems kind of dopey, but there's a lot of goodwill. And I think the people who like that rapport that the two actors have are going to have a good time. And I think that's probably why it's doing so well.
I think the popularity of the movie too is that, you know, I don't know if you've been following the news lately, but autism is a very big deal. You know, a very controversial deal. So, you know, all RFK Jr. has to do is say the word autism and it like sets off 7 days of online shrieking across the ideological spectrum parents who are like at war because like parents with kids with severe autism hate parents of kids who don't have severe autism but still have autism and vice versa. And there's just a lot of it's very embattled. But I feel like there are a lot more people who are either autistic or, you know, sort of a neurodivergent, as they say, on the spectrum. And I feel like, you know, the Ben Affleck character can kind of be a, you know, a hero for them.
I guess it can be a bit of a hero. I do feel like it's being kind of exploited for narrative purposes here, where they make autistic characters seem like they have these almost like extra sensory powers of perception.
Yeah, it's kind of like there's like that TV show, The Good Doctor, who's like a like an autistic super doctor, and I'm just like, I don't think so. And I watched this show called Love on the Spectrum. It's made by this Australian producer, and it's like autistic people trying to date. And I'm just saying, like, it's a genre. Like, autism is a genre of entertainment. Autistic characters.
Autism is hot.
I don't know if it's hot, but it is. But it is. There are a lot of people who have it. And a lot of people who have family members who have it. And I feel like, it's a stereotype, the way that, I guess it's the stereotype, the way they portray Ben Affleck's character. But it does explain, to some extent, the popularity of the franchise.
Well, and I think in the first movie, they took that autism aspect of his character a bit more seriously.
Yeah.
You know, like even Ben Affleck's performance was stilted, but not exaggerated in this new one. It's like a caricature, and he almost sounds like he's speaking with a weird accent, and like he's really leaning into like, I am very like, it's very Rain Man. You know what I mean? Like, why are you doing this?
Right. But now you're looking at potentially The Accountant 3, because The Accountant 2 has done well. So it's
they've already talking about it. And actually Anna Kendrick was in the first one. So they've been talking about bringing her back for the third one so that there's a bit of an arc with her and Ben Affleck. There's this weird, okay, so Ben Affleck's character when he was a kid was at this institute that helped, you know, studied neurodivergent children. And one of them is this woman who is has, I guess, nonverbal autism, but she uses this computer to speak. And so she has this British accent. And so she's kind of like, you know, what's her name from 24? You know, Jack Bauer had that voice in his head all the time.
Yes, Chloe.
Chloe. It is kind of like his Chloe. And then they keep cutting back to Chloe, and she has this insane array of monitors and computer equipment at this, like, otherwise this institute that's supposed to study, this clinic that's supposed to be studying autism. And then, like, at one point you see her and she's got this, like, room full of, like, underage kids who are all, like, apparently savants, like, autistic savants who are helping her with her computer stuff. And you're just like, that's not how it works. You know, you guys took it a little more seriously and were a little more realistic in the first movie. Now it's just like a superpower to be autistic, which is like, what?
Doesn't seem grounded in realism. Speaking of not grounded in realism, I wanted to talk real briefly about a movie that is not part of this week's box office bonanza, at least not gauging from the sad crowd of 17 people at the Austin Film Society.
It opened this weekend, right?
Opened this weekend, but I saw it at the Austin Film Society. I'm talking about David Cronenberg's The Shrouds.
It's been decades since I had to seduce a woman.
You'll never replace Becca.
I'm not trying to.
What happened?
It's like a tracking device.
It's obvious they were tracking you through her.
Why would they do that?
It's not meant for the living.
Maybe not meant for the dead either.
A new movie from, he's in his 80s, like 83-year-old Canadian filmmaker David Cronenberg, who was doing body horror since before I had a body. And The Shrouds is his latest effort. Now, Stephen is not allowed to talk about this film critically, because a lot of frequent listeners of the show may know that Stephen has a company that does movie marketing and designs posters and trailers and works with Janus Films, which is the independent film company that helped distribute The Shrouds. So Stephen can only talk about The Shrouds in a very abstract sense. He's going to have to shroud his opinion.
I'm going to have to shroud my opinion, but I will
but,
say...
But basically, look, I am a fan of David Cronenberg movies. I mean, he is a true, authentic indie film legend. He has made some extremely great and bizarre films. The Shrouds felt like something very, very end career. The script was
end career or end your career, end his career.
I hope it's not the end of my career, because I still have bills to pay. I think the end of his career, right? It's a very odd and stilted film. Like, I felt like it had been translated into a foreign language and then translated back into English. And certain connective tissue of the plot had been lost along the way, and there was just some weird, awkward stuff. And I think part of the reason is that Vincent Cassel Cassel or Cassel? It's Cassel, right?
Cassel.
Vincent Cassel, the French actor, plays the lead character who is a, he calls himself an industrial filmmaker, but he's also, I guess, a tech genius, and he's designed these shrouds, these really cool things that you you wrap corpses in and you bury them, and they have these highly sensitive cameras inside, and he owns a cemetery where you bury people in these shrouds. That also, for some reason, has a gourmet restaurant in it, which makes no sense whatsoever. You like eat, you can eat lunch while watching your loved one decay from above. Yeah, and so he invents these, and so people can like watch their loved ones' corpses inside these shrouds. Very, you know, it's kind of it's an odd concept. It's very Black Mirror, and the concept in it of itself is very Cronenberg and not bad, but I feel like, and he's also one of the original shrouded people is his wife, who we see in flashback, is what I think her name was Rebecca, played by Diane Kruger. And if we were to gather from the flashbacks he has about Rebecca, she was always naked. She was never not naked. You always could see her breasts, or at least one of her breasts. And she has a sister who is sort of not quite a twin, but was also played by Diane Kruger, who's also almost always naked. In fact, all the women in this movie are almost always naked. I don't know if you
Vincent Cassel gets a little naked, doesn't he? Isn't there a point where...
Yeah, Vincent Cassel gets naked too, but he's in every scene, so he's not naked. He's almost every scene, so he's not naked in every scene.
Can I give a little background too? Because I think this is kind of interesting. Yeah. Like Cronenberg's wife died in 2017, and that it was an inspiration for this movie because he fell into a dark depression, and one of his immediate reactions when he buried her was, I want to just crawl up into the coffin and be with her, because they'd been married 43 years or something like that. And so this was the impetus for the film, which is, you know, that this character, Vincent Cassel, makes it possible for people to watch their loved ones basically decay in real time with these sensors, these cameras that are on these shrouds that you wrap the bodies in and then bury them. And then you can watch them you have a 24-hour like kind of death cam or rotting corpse cam.
Yeah. That was the cool part of the movie. And I thought, you know, that grief stuff felt very real, but there was a lot of other plot about the Chinese embedding chips into the dead bodies and using the shrouds to set up an international surveillance network. And then Vincent Cassel has this odd AI avatar named Honey, who looks a lot like his ex-wife, but you know, she's being controlled by some sinister force. There's a lot of stuff that just doesn't make sense. The political conspiracy stuff was not good.
Were there aspects, I mean, I'm saying this biased because I'm on the payroll, but also because I'm a big fan of Cronenberg and Sideshow Janice. Were there aspects of the film that intrigued you or that you thought were interesting or have stayed with you?
Yeah, this is like suddenly I'm your focus group. I didn't think there was enough about the shrouds. Honestly, like I felt like I wanted more shroud. I wanted more shroud. I wanted more corpse surveillance. That to me was the interesting stuff. These sort of sexual subplots and the political conspiracy subplot involving characters who we never see. We hear talk about a lot, but we never really see. You know, it all felt a little abstract and weird. And I felt like there were scenes missing. It was kind of like two movies in one. So I felt if you wanted to make this somehow a grief parable and use the shrouds as a way to talk about that, I think that would have worked. But the extra plot that Cronenberg added, I just don't think is his strong suit. He's a director of, you know, of mood and kind of eerie body horror. And, you know, he does film a good kinky sex scene. You know,
there's a lot of sex in this movie.
A lot of sex. Nice foreboding music. You know, he does all of that stuff. He does extremely well, but because the political subplot was so stupid and the Guy Pearce character, was so stupid that it created a lot of unintentional comedy that I think took away from the more serious themes and the creepiness that Cronenberg was trying to get across.
You know, I one of the things I admire about Cronenberg, and he's very consistent throughout his whole career, and he's talked about his own atheism and his own existentialism, where we are our bodies are us, and when we die, we rot and dissolve and turn to dust. And so all of his movies explore, I mean, you said body horror, and that's, of course, it was coined to describe his films, and he's popularized that approach. But I think there's also a way of looking at his movies that are very much about the finality of life and how there are limits to our own capabilities, our flesh. And so I think what's interesting is how much sex is in his movies, because that is part of our experience of carnality, you know. And I thought it was really intriguing before I saw this film, the idea of literally watching a corpse decay. I was like, that's so on brand for Cronenberg, you know. And I thought it was interesting, his previous film, Crimes of the Future, which I'd be curious to hear your opinion
on. Which was much better than this, but that's because the story was better.
Well, and it was about extending your life by, I think, creating new organs. Your body actually creates new organs, right? Or they would take organs out.
Right, and I think we either talked about this with you or with someone else on the show. You know, that movie also is about, you know, humanity evolving suit itself to the age of plastics.
So you can digest plastic.
So you can digest plastic, and it's actually right. Nourishing.
Your body has, or they found bodies that have developed new organs that digest plastic.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's to adjust that. It's like literally an evolutionary tactic. It's fat, you know, and great, you know, and I felt like the plot was better. Whereas this, you know, had some interesting things to say about how we view death and how we view burial of the dead and how we remember the dead. But I just don't think Cronenberg's strength is trying to fold that into some sort of weird cyber techno thriller. Not really his genre. You know what I'm saying?
I'm trying to think of an analog in his career, like Existence, which...
Existence.
That was kind of bumping. Yeah.
Videodrome. I mean, it's not like he's not concerned with technology. He just... He didn't quite feel with it here. You know, it's like the avatar, the AI avatar was literally cartoonish. I just feel like, you know, I watch a lot of Black Mirror, and I feel like Black Mirror does stuff like that better. Whereas no one does body horror and death and carnal knowledge of death better than David Cronenberg. And so you have 45 minutes of that and like an endless amount of weird geopolitical subplot that just simply doesn't work on any level. And there was a lot of unintentional laughter in my theater. Some of it coming from me, Stephen, I have to admit.
How were the other five people?
There were about 16 people. I think maybe only 12 of them were actually alive by the end of the movie. We had to put them in shrouds.
Were they rotting? Were they?
No, they died during the movie, so they hadn't really started to rot. Yeah, well, that's usually the case when you go to like the Film Society, though. It's an older crowd, so
I am happy that they bought tickets and that they're supporting a legacy director like Cronenberg.
Goddamn right, and that's, you know, and the thing is, movies are back. You know,
movies are back. I don't know if you saw the box office, but movies are back.
Movies are back, which means that you and I will get another. It's like we're like Punxsutawney Phil. We get another 6 months of employment. you come out of your hole, you see that the box office is up, and you can keep going to the movies for the next 6 months. All right, Stephen, I will talk to you soon.
Okay.
All right, thank you so much, Stephen Garrett. You can see The Accountant 2 in most movie theaters right now, and you can see The Shrouds in some movie theaters right now, depending on where you live. That's not quite as big a breakout hit, to say the least, as The Accountant 2. But regardless, the movies are there for you to go to, and all our efforts. I take full credit for reviving the American cinema-going experience. Movies are back. We have a long movie-going summer ahead of us. And I encourage you all to join me, not me specifically, I want the theater to myself, but to join your fellow people in going to the movies. And also thanks to Scott Gold for talking to me about Andor, which would actually, I think, be pretty good on a big screen, but it works very well as a Star Wars television show as well. I am Neil Pollack. I am the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We are a product of Sea of Reeds Media, which operates two independent bookstores in New Jersey, the Bookhouse in Millburn and the Bookhouse on Long Branch on the Jersey Shore. I encourage you both, not both of you, but to to go to both stores and to patronize our bookhouse stores, both in person and on bookshop.org, your one-stop shop for all independent bookstores. You can set up the bookhouse as an affiliate link there. That's what I do when I shop at Bookshop, and the bookhouse is infinitely richer because of it. Thank you so much for joining me on the program this week, and I'll talk to you soon.
Original production. The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at the Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.